whenever we talk about the conflicts in terms of the foreign policy of the United States in Ukraine, in the Middle East, the future of China and the situation between China and the United States, the main factor to be evaluated is the military of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump came to power. He thought that he can defeat Yemen, and he sent and he tried to fight Yemenis so far. How do you find, what is the situation, the current situation of the American army? And how did you see the way that Yemenis are fighting the United States in the Red Sea?
No, we have to understand, by not trying to denigrate United States Army, it's definitely the army with its own history. There are some own, esprit de corps. And then you have, of course, yes, when we say army, you have to understand armed forces. And there is, of course, glorious U.S. Navy, which is, made a gigantic reputation, totally deservedly, during the Pacific War. So I by no means try to, denigrate or diminish them. But truth is, for the last 30 years, well, more than that, actually, it was primarily the mythology, U.S. media, and they call it for a reason that it was military-industrial media congressional complex. So, and U.S. media and Hollywood are really good in promoting this, clean image, and but reality is, of course, it never was as powerful as it is tried to portray itself. And even by 1970s, the all fighting concepts, for example, of the U.S. Navy and its carrier-centric nature have been basically put into question by none other than at that time Chief of Naval Operations Elmer Zumwalt, Admiral Elmer Zumwalt. Because with the development of the long-range strike capabilities, and these were Russians who introduced first, real anti-shipping cruise missiles which could hit things, as Israelis learned in 1967 after Eilat was sunk by Egyptian Kamar-class missile cutters, essentially. So, then suddenly the whole idea that you can move there, this floating, rumbling, giant of the CBM, the nuclear power carrier, to some third world country, and you can start bombing it because using the obviously the deck cycle, as much you can launch all those either sustained strikes or alpha strikes or whatever what have you. It kind of feed American psychology of the war, and the really idealized idea about the air power. And as a result, you see yourself today that it's not that difficult to exhaust the stores of the missiles in what is the today the carrier battle group and its main air defense complex, if you wish, which usually a couple of the Arleigh-Burke class destroyers with 96 cells of the MK-41 VLS, which is vertical launch system. Not all of them obviously carry the anti-air defense missiles, but at least half of them does. And those are ranging from SM-3s for intercepting ballistic missiles. They think that they can't really. But, and all kinds of other missiles, they have the SM-6. So that's about it, they have their ream, those Sea Sparrows variants, which is evolution of the those missiles, and what it takes. It takes probably, 100 drones to immediately, make it expendable, essentially, the whole store of those missiles, and then suddenly what happens? You have to move your aircraft carrier, which is an extremely valuable asset. The carrier itself, the hull, without air wing, is anywhere between $10 to $13 billion. It is immensely the most expensive asset in military ever. So, can you imagine the political and actually military ramifications if something hits it? let alone if something damages it, not to speak about sinking it. So what do? You have to move it away deeper into the ocean or into the sea to stay away from all those, well, long-range fires. They could be very primitive, but still they can fly hundreds of kilometers. And suddenly, everything you knew about it, yeah, you can fly your F-18s, whatever you want, and you can bomb the whatever, you know, from Yemenis, for example, that they have enough wherewithal there to continue to launch those old subsonic anti-shipping missiles, which are shut down, obviously. But when you have enough of them, what do? You deplete the carrier battle group of its defensive weapons. Simple as that. Of course, they theoretically can go and get all those F-18s with, you know, with the shoot down, look down, shoot down capability, you know, against the clutter of this sea, and shoot down some missiles or some drones, but you will not be able to control it completely. And as a result, we saw what happened to Truman aircraft carrier a few days back, when it had to maneuver very violently to evidently avoid the whatever was flying towards it. And basically what happened, it you know, one of the F-18s and the TAG, the, you know, the thing which you know, the which moves it around the deck, they fell over the deck pretty much. That was the result. You see, that's simple. You do not have to have any more one-for-one type of the weaponry weapon system. You can do it just basic math and basic technologies.
What can they do, in your opinion, in with the case of Yemen? Is that an option to go underground to fight Yemen?
Yeah, that probably inserted some forces, you know, they're like special forces, I don't know, SEALs or what have you, but obviously they are not capable to conduct real warfare. No, United States cannot go into Yemen unless it wants to experience second Afghanistan, okay, and that will actually also mobilize other people to come to help. So it's... No, United States cannot take casualties, and so that's the result. And yes, this operation now lasts for what? It has the funniest name ever, Prosperity Guardian. You know, it's just like, what the hell is that? But yeah, it doesn't achieve any success. And the main goal, military and political goal, to unblocking the essentially Red Sea and Suez Canal, hasn't been achieved. There are marine traffic there is down 90%. Evidently, who just won? You know, if they can keep this thing, you know, closed, and they have to go around, you know, Africa, which is extremely expensive and it's much longer. So yeah, it is what it is. I mean, nothing could be changed about it. And it doesn't matter how many. Well, you theoretically can put all aircraft carriers there. They can bring definitely a serious air power, but, you know, what can I say? I mean, it's what are they going to bomb? You see, that's the other funny part. They can bomb only civilian targets primarily. That's the thing.
Yeah, they're short of targets in Yemen because they don't have that much of intelligence coming out of Yemen.
No, yeah, you can do some through the satellite and recon flights, but Yemenis shoot down those Reapers, MQ-9, whatever the name of those drones, really nicely, you know, that they know how to deal with that thing, you know. So in this case, yeah, you have their limitations in terms of the intel. You have to obviously have the targets and you have to identify them. Otherwise, it all ends up the same as in Afghanistan. You blew up their family or, you know, wedding or any kind of party of the civilians, women and children. So that's what you end up doing. But reality is, of course, yeah, you have to have a very good intelligence. You have to have a high probability of identifying targets. But evidently, it's not the case anymore. And as I already stated also, that once you begin to move your aircraft carrier away, which is like now suddenly it's hundreds of kilometers. You cannot move it closer than, I don't know, 300, 500 kilometers. So suddenly your ranges become, well, much longer for your aviation. You know, you have to constantly have those. They have the F-18s, which serve as the refuel aircraft, or you have to have the larger aircraft, which have to fly into the area to, you know, get your fuel for your attack package, you know, F-18s, and that suddenly complicates the situation, you know, and again, you have to put your carrier back to port to replenish this constantly expanded, you know, this ammunition stocks and stores and things of this nature. So yeah, it becomes very complex. I mean, it's you can definitely kind of secure more or less your carrier on station, but this is until, and that's where it all becomes interesting. Many people ask if they have their Houthis have their Bastion and P-800 Onyx in the export version, which is Yahant. It goes onto the export as Yahant. Syrians used to have that. It's 300 kilometer range. It's limited by 300 kilometer range against the, it's standard between 800 and 1000 kilometer range. But this is a completely different game. And that's why I also think that's why they moved the carrier also back, you know, in towards the sea, because with Yahant, it's a completely different game. These are Mach 2.5, and they are violently maneuvering, and they are actually have their, well, what would we define today as artificial intelligence. So do they have that? Who knows? You know, what it takes, if you read actually the book by Douglas McGregor, which was his best book ever. After that, it wasn't as good, but that was an outstanding book, Breaking the Phalanx. And he says that what it takes to scare the carrier battle group is somebody to drop the drum of oil accidentally overboard and everybody like freaking out. Here, what it takes, somebody can simply insert the even fictitious information that, oh yeah, they received Yahants. And guess what? That would immediately, they have to go, because in this case, it's very difficult to intercept that, if possible at all, if it is a salvo, and you don't want to deal with this, because that thing, single missile can sink the destroyer, okay? So, and that's the conundrum U.S. Navy is facing now, and yeah, that is why there's very little success. You cannot just, you know, go around there bombing something. They bomb some caves, maybe, you know, so they have the good infrared and good, you know, optronic systems too, but other than that, you have to go to Sana. What are you going to do with Sana, the capital? Do you want to bomb the whole city with the civilians? You know how it will look like. So that's what we have. Let's put it this way. While the United States remains the nuclear superpower, there are a number of technological issues which the United States is facing now, which they do not want to admit, or as some of our common acquaintance was trying to sell as some kind of unheard of achievement, when in reality it is there actually a manifestation of the inferiority. For example, those fuses for the nuclear MIRS, from multiple reentry vehicles, for Trident II missiles, or for that matter, but especially Trident II missiles. The reason being is because in order to defeat, for example, the Silas of the modern Russian, already starting from the 70s, actually, but 80s and now, is, what is the Silas of the land-based ballistic missile in Russia? It can withstand direct hit, but exploding over it, you know, up to 150 to 200 kilotons. It will still remain operational. So what you need to do, especially when you shoot with the Tridents, you, in order for you to diminish the time, to cut the time of the flight of the those, the, you know, the bus itself, the missile and the bus when it separates and then warheads fly, you do it by the suppressed ballistic trajectory. that not this parabola, you know, but it's much more suppressed, you know. It still flies into space, but it is much more suppressed. And what you have, you begin to lose, because it is obviously suppressed, you begin to lose accuracy. So what you need to do? You need to some kind of diffuse which have to at least explode over the silo. And that's the only thing which is essentially tells you, oh, okay, so you're suppressed, you still cannot hit it, you know. So, and this is exactly what is happening. Now, what would be, for example, in this case, the, you know, bunker buster nuclear device, you probably will have to have some same technology like the bunker buster, but with the nuclear warhead, which can penetrate deeper. Could it be done? Yeah, I'm pretty sure they could, but that's the issue. There is a huge issue with the nukes themselves and processing and creating new nuclear warheads for the United States. It is issue with the plutonium and all kinds of things of this nature. So, we have to understand, whenever we talk about it, is it technologically feasible? Yes. But what if they use nuclear weapons on Houthis? That is going to be the outcry all over the world, and they will humiliate themselves even more themselves, because that will tell you how impotent they are to deal with this threat. And make no mistake, while sympathizing with people of Gaza and all that, you know, and even with Houthis, I understand, but what they do is actually against the international law. They did indeed choke one of the major choke points of the shipping lanes of communications for the international trade. So it's kind of like, it's such a, how to say, blade running also, almost like. And so in this case, the political consequences will be horrendous for the United States. Horrendous. I mean, it's just, my gosh. So if they decide to do it, let alone if they try to do this to Iran, my gosh, let's not go there. It's going to be United States will not recognize itself the next day, if God forbids it happens, you know, because of the reaction of the international community and the rest of it.
So far, the United States has lost 22 MQ-9 Reaper and two by this, the last F-18, two F-18s. What's going on, in your opinion, and who's responsible for what's going on in the Red Sea? Is that it was, because on the part of the United States, Yemenis are talking, they targeted the aircraft carrier. On the part of the United States, was an accident. How do you find it?
I think what you're referencing is the loss of an F-18, which was being towed into position. I don't know if it was being taken out for launch or having recovered, being brought back. But the bottom line is the F-18 was under tow. That means that there's a vehicle on the deck that it's hooked up to, and it's moving it. And that somehow that aircraft and the vehicle ended up going over the side of the ship. It's not an accident. That just doesn't happen by accident. This is something that's been done over and over and over again. The safety protocols are in place, etc. But the Truman is operating in a war zone. It's launching aircraft that are carrying out strikes against Yemen, and Yemen is responding by targeting the Truman carrier battle group. And apparently, a Yemeni weapon system, I believe it was probably a drone, approached, and the Truman was compelled to take emergency evasive action. And when that happens, the ship is making a hard turn, and you know they will make an announcement, but you're where you're at when that happens. And apparently this hard turn to evade being struck by this drone was such that the F-18 and the vehicle that was towing it were thrown overboard. That's an extremely hard turn. That's this isn't a gradual turn. This is a major adjustment to the direction of the ship. That only happens in an emergency, literally to avoid being struck by a hostile weapon system. Look, we're at war. You know, let's wake up to that reality. The United States is accustomed to taking on nations like Yemen using aircraft carriers where the carrier battle group operates with relative impunity. You know, off the shores. We did this with Iraq during the Gulf War. We've done it even prior to that, striking Lebanon, striking Libya. We're just used to our carriers operating, with little regard to potential hostile action. Welcome to the new world. Yemen has developed capabilities to interdict shipping. And this means not just civilian shipping, but targeting military shipping as well. And the carrier battle group is not immune to this. It's, it's just a reflection of the fact that, we are at war against an enemy who is capable. And if we're not careful, we could wake up one morning to find that the Truman has been struck by one of these systems and, there's been damage and things of that nature. I think it's also a wake-up call to the United States that the day of carrier battle groups operating off hostile shores with impunity are over. Yemen doesn't possess the most modern anti-shipping weapon systems. If they did, we'd be in a lot of trouble. But imagine if we were going up against Russia, or imagine if we were going up against China, or going up against Iran, nations that have more advanced anti-shipping capability. We would lose a carrier. The carrier would be struck. If not sunk, it would have to be withdrawn from combat operations. These are very expensive propositions, the carrier and its attached carrier wing, the aircraft. We're talking, hundreds of billions of dollars, plus the thousands of, American personnel that are stationed on board. We're going to have to make some adjustments in how we do business. The carrier is going to either have to operate further from shore, which means that we're going to need, longer range aircraft, or we're going to have to rely more upon, air-to-air refueling, or we're going to have to come up with different standoff weapon systems. The aircraft carrier is very much a legacy system. America became addicted to the aircraft carrier back in the Second World War, and the aircraft carrier served very effectively in the projection of American military power. We used the carrier during the Korean conflict. We used the carrier during the Vietnam conflict. But again, basically those two wars saw the aircraft carrier just casually sailing, offshore, launching aircraft. During the Second World War, our carriers were attacked. We had several sunk. The Japanese, up until the end, were flying kamikaze missions, seeking to, strike. And the kamikaze missions are sort of the precursor to these attack drones. We've come full circle, except that these carriers have become, they're not disposable weapons. They're not weapons that the average military leader, during the Second World War, we were accustomed to the reality that we were going to lose ships, including aircraft carriers. Today, the aircraft carrier is not built to be lost. It's built to be a presence for a considerable period of time. We have a finite number of these. We don't have the mentality of saying, okay, well, we lost a carrier, we'll just replace it with another carrier. We don't lose carriers. We're going to in the near future if we continue to put carriers in harm's way against enemies that are developing, you know, better anti-shipping capabilities.
Yeah. CNN reported that Houthis' successful targeting of U.S. drones is hampering Trump's mission to kill group's senior leadership. Do you think that Donald Trump is still insisting on the operation in the Red Sea, or he's going to reconsider his decision about fighting Houthis? He knows what's going on, what has been going on for such a long time.
I don't know if he knows what's going on. That's an assumption on our part. It's based upon two things. One, what he's been briefed on, and two, what he's capable of comprehending. Donald Trump lives in his own world. And he populates this world with figures and facts that often that aren't necessarily reflective of reality. He also is a man who has an inflated sense of worth. And, you know, he has given this interview in Atlantic magazine where he projects upon himself godlike capabilities. It's embarrassing. No American leader is God. And the arrogance that he displays in this interview is just astounding, astounding. He has saved America. He has saved the world. No, he hasn't even come close. I mean, he's trying to improve America and, you know, trying to improve the world from an American perspective. But the idea that he's saving anything is ludicrous. And the reason why I bring this up is not necessarily to be critical of Donald Trump, but just to reflect on the fact that the man is so far removed from reality that you can't assume that he's being briefed properly on anything. One, you know, how do you brief a narcissist? How do you tell a narcissist that which he doesn't want to hear? And two, when you do get access to this narcissist, is his brain capable of absorbing data that, you know, that contradicts the world that he's created in his own mind? So I don't think Donald Trump's aware of anything. I think he's put out some objectives, and the Secretary of Defense is trying to achieve those objectives. Donald Trump's been briefed that we have a multi-phase operation taking place in Yemen, where we went in to seek to interdict the Yemeni ability to launch weapon systems against Israel and against shipping. And then we move on to phase two, which is to defeat the Houthi leadership by, you know, identifying where they are and putting, you know, missiles into those locations. The ideal platform for this has been historically the MQ-9 Reaper drone. This is what we've used historically in the war on terror. We've used this effectively in Afghanistan. Donald Trump is intimately familiar with the use of drones. We've used it in Yemen in the past. We've used it in Somalia. We've used it in Iraq and Syria. It's the go-to weapon system. And so the planners basically said, we're now going to go into eliminating high-value targets, and we're going to use, you know, the operational methodologies that we've used in the past with great success to target. And the Houthi are saying, well, we're not playing that game. You know, we're not just going to drive around and let you do pattern of life analysis and figure out where we are and put missiles in. We're going to shoot you down. We're going to contest our airspace. The MQ-9 Reaper is not meant to be operating in contested airspace. And as a result, we've lost, 23 or 24 of these things over, the, you know, since our involvement. I mean, and many of these were lost since October 7th, since the United States has become involved in Yemen in this fresh round. And this is disruptive because we're not achieving the goals and objectives of the intervention. We haven't achieved any aspect of it. The fact that the Truman had to make a hard maneuver proves that the Yemenis haven't been deterred or, you know, prevented from continuing to project their power into the region. Shipping isn't free to pass through the Red Sea. You know, so again, the hubris that we've moved on to phase two and we haven't even accomplished phase one, which means that we're putting more emphasis on phase two, recognizing that the only way to get the Yemeni to stop firing these missiles is to kill their leadership. And now we're doubling down on that, but we don't have the tools to do this. The intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, ISR, that is normally attached to, you know, targeting efforts related to the drone, doesn't work here because we're not able to loiter over over Yemen to collect the information, to do the long-term analysis. In Afghanistan, the drones sort of hovered over everything, looking at all the movement, and you had people back, in Las Vegas or wherever they're at, looking at the screen, and they've been looking at that target forever, and they see something different, they call it in, and then they strike it. Now that Reaper is either being shot down or has to alter its flight parameters so that you're not getting that long duration look at a target. We're failing. Our military mission is failing. Now, that's what should be briefed to the president. Mr. President, our campaign has not achieved any of the objectives that we wanted it to. We have not prevented the Houthi from launching into the Red Sea. Shipping is still at risk. Israel is still at risk. The Yemeni continue to fire into Israel. And we're unable to achieve the dominance of the airspace necessary for us to effectively carry out a drone-based anti-leadership campaign. So we probably need to either find a way out of this through negotiation, or we're going to have to revamp our war plan because this isn't working. But nobody's telling them that.
But has the United States ever tried to talk with Yemenis, or they don't consider them as important?
We've talked with them. We took them off our terrorist organization list during the Biden administration as a conversation. And we were engaged with them directly and indirectly about Saudi Arabia in the conflict with Saudi Arabia to bring that to a close. So we have the ability to interface with the Houthi either directly or through proxy. That's not the issue. The issue is the arrogance of the Trump administration into believing that because it wants something to happen, it will happen. It's not happening. We're not getting what we want. In fact, we're making the Houthi even stronger because, all wars are extensions of politics by other means. And politically, I mean, this is empowering for the Houthi. They are standing up to the strength of the United States, and they're prevailing. And God forbid they actually successfully hit an American warship. I mean, this would be devastating for the United States.
When you talk about the intelligence not getting to Donald Trump, the intelligence is, do you think that Tulsi Gabbard would not share the intelligence coming from the military, from, I don't know, other part of the intelligence, considering the case of Yemen? Who's responsible for that if he's not receiving the intelligence?
Tulsi Gabbard is the director of national intelligence. She's the figure above the intelligence community. But the Pentagon doesn't get its intelligence from Tulsi Gabbard. The Pentagon gets its intelligence from the Defense Intelligence Agency, which then is reliant upon deployed combatant resources that have intelligence integrated into that. The analysis, the underlying analysis about all military aspects related to Yemen do not come from the Director of National Intelligence. They come from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And some extent, to the extent that the CIA has been integrated with some of these military efforits through their paramilitary organs, the CIA will also lend itself to that. But when Pete Hegseth briefs the President of the United States about what's going on in Yemen, Tulsi Gabbard has no input to that whatsoever. That's not her bailiwick. It's not her job. She's a manager. She's supposed to affect the effective interoperability of America's numerous intelligence agencies. The whole idea of the Director of National Intelligence was to prevent the intelligence failure that took place because in the lead up to 9/11, where the FBI and the CIA just weren't talking. And they had information about the hijackers that they didn't share. The Director of National Intelligence was supposed to be breaking through that and creating this kind of interoperability. Since then, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has taken on, some functions that previously were done by the director of the CIA. The director of the CIA used to be the the big boss of the intelligence community, but now he's just the director of, or she, of a subordinate agency to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Strategic assessments are the job of the Director of National Intelligence. And if the Director of National Intelligence is ordered to by the president to provide an assessment of what's going on in Yemen, then they will do that. But the Director of National Intelligence does not run a day-to-day situation room about Yemen. That's the job of the Pentagon. That's the job of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That's the job of the Secretary of Defense. That's the job of Central Command. And these are the agencies that will provide the intelligence, not the DNI.
Do you see the role of Netanyahu in sending in this decision of Donald Trump to send again U.S. forces to into the Red Sea to fight with Yemen? It was all about Trump and his administration, or someone Israeli lobby, or maybe Netanyahu has some sort of role in that decision?
First, I understand that Donald Trump didn't invent this conflict. This happened under Joe Biden in December when the Yemenis began, December of 2023. So it's been over a year. It began their interdiction of the shipping. I think it was Operation Guardian or something of that nature. We began deploying ships. We tried to build a coalition of nations to support us. Nobody would do that. So we ended up going alone with a handful of regional partners, European partners. But the idea was to protect shipping. And we've not been able to effectuate that. This was Joe Biden that did it. We did it because we have a longstanding relationship with Israel. This isn't about Benjamin Netanyahu. This is about Israel and the survival of Israel. This de facto blockade that the Yemeni have been able to impose on Israel, the southern blockade, shutting down the strategic port of Eilat. Disrupting the Israeli economy to the tunes of, you know, tens of billions of dollars of losses. This was, you know, part of the calculation that led many people, including myself, to say that if this doesn't change, Israel will lose this war. So the United States, in order to save its ally, intervened militarily to try and stop the Houthi from doing it. And we failed miserably. I mean, we failed absolutely. One of the reasons why Donald Trump push for the ceasefire early on was that was the only way you were going to get the Yemeni to stop interdicting shipping and stop striking Israel, because they said everything we do is linked to what's happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. So the ceasefire brought a cessation to the to the Yemeni military intervention. But when Israel broke the ceasefire and began operations against Gaza, the Yemeni once again stepped up. So all Donald Trump did is continue the policy that was put in place by Joe Biden, the policy of protecting Yemen. This is not about Benjamin Netanyahu. This is about Israel. This is about the United States protecting Israel. And it's about international shipping. I mean, as much as, you know, I'm sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, I of course support, the Palestinians in their struggle against Israel, support Palestinian statehood, and therefore believe that Yemen is doing the morally correct thing in stepping up and taking action against an entity, Israel, that has been labeled as genocidal by the International Court of Justice. Their actions are, conducive to genocide. Yemen is on the right side of history here. They're on the wrong side of the law, though. Free passage of shipping, is doesn't happen when you have nations firing cruise missiles and drones and sinking ships and striking ships. And so we are stepping up in not only in defense of Israel, but again, in defense of the principle of, unimpeded navigation through international waterways. Again, that has nothing to do with Netanyahu. It has everything to do with the fact that America is a nation that is dependent upon secure sea lines of communication. And that's one of the reasons why we have the Navy that we have, and we project the power that we do have so that we can keep these strategic lines of communication open. This is why we're, for instance, very much interested in what's going on in the South China Sea with China building these new island bases, because it's not just about the projection of Chinese control beyond what we believe is legitimate based upon the territorial reach of China, but this is about those bases being positioned to interdict absolutely vital sea lines of communication that connect the South with Japan, Taiwan, South Korea. This is one of the reasons why our Navy continues to go in there, because we believe in freedom of navigation. So, this conflict, I mean, I have to be honest, if I were president of the United States, I mean, I would seek obviously to solve this thing by getting a ceasefire in place that resolves the issue. But if the Yemeni continue to interdict shipping, we have no choice but to retaliate. I think right now, though, getting back to the original gist of your question, either we have to change what we're doing militarily, which would mean boots on the ground, or we have to change things politically to get the Yemeni to stop what they're doing, which means promote a ceasefire in Gaza. One of those two things are going to have to happen, because what we're currently doing is not succeeding, and it's putting our forces at risk. The U.S. Navy and Central Command need to do a risk assessment of what's going on here. Because the more you operate there, the more the Yemeni are learning about U.S. carrier-borne operations. There's only so much we can do with the carrier. When you're launching or recovering ships, there's a specific profile the ship has to maintain that makes it vulnerable to attack. If you're recovering aircraft, you can't be doing violent maneuvering. As the Yemeni collect more and more information about how the carrier battle group operates, where the different support ships are, the air defense umbrellas are, and what the vulnerabilities of these umbrellas are, they're getting better at targeting the carrier battle group. The Eisenhower apparently had a Yemeni missile or drone impact 200 meters off of its bow. 200 meters. That's pretty damn close. And now we don't have all the details about what happened with the Truman here, but clearly, had it continued on its course, it probably would have been struck by a Yemeni munition. The Yemeni are only going to get more effective, more better, more accurate. And if I were the intelligence officer or the commander, I would ask for an intelligence assessment as to what our vulnerabilities are going forward, and are we able to overcome this by increasing the number of anti-air ships? Do we have to stand off at a greater distance? And if we don't do anything, if we continue with this mission, we need to be honest to the president and to the Secretary of Defense what the potential outcomes could be, that we could be struck, that we could lose one of our $100 billion aircraft carriers. And you need to put people on notice and saying, is this the outcome we're willing to do? I mean, if you're a Marine rifle company commander and you've been ordered to secure territory or defend or attack something, and it's going to be contested, you're going to lose Marines. That's just the way it is. Your goal, however, is to mitigate those losses through effective maneuvering, fire support, etc. We have to accept the fact that we're going to suffer casualties if we want to continue to go forward. But now if I'm the Marine Rifle Company commander and I'm given a mission and I come back to my boss and say, I'm going to lose 80% of my Marines, and at the end of the day, I won't be able to hold the position. Is this really what you want me to do? The Navy and Central Command need to start coming to the president and saying, and the Secretary of Defense saying, if we continue this, we're going to lose a carrier. And is this what you want us to do? Do you want us to continue going forward knowing that the probable outcome will be we're going to lose an aircraft carrier? Or do you want to reevaluate what we're doing? Because normally that's considered unacceptable losses.